You're listening to The Psychedologist. This is Consciousness Positive Radio. The riveting Rebecca Martinez comes on the show for a conversation about her new book, Whole Medicine. In this episode, you will hear about the natural world as central in the conversation about people, plant medicine, ethics, and expanded states, Alma Institute, being on both sides of the altar, power, harm, and responsibility, normalizing conflict, a wish for this book to educate and empower the psychedelic naive, shrinking the power dynamics between facilitators and journeyers, and a pondering of, how are the medicines doing? Finally, Rebecca reads an excerpt from the Whole Medicine book for us. I highly recommend it. There's a link to purchase it in the show notes. A little bit about Rebecca. She's a Chicana parent, writer, community organizer, and social entrepreneur living in Portland, Oregon. She's the founder and executive director of Alma Institute, a nonprofit educational institution that equips trainees from marginalized communities to become legal psilocybin facilitators. She is also the author of Whole Medicine, a guide to ethics for psychedelic therapy and plant medicine communities, published by North Atlantic Books in 2024. She is a voice on psychedelic justice and has been featured in NPR, Business Insider, Stat News, Lucid News, and Psychedelics Today. Rebecca, welcome to The Psychedologist.
Thank you for having me. So happy to be here.
I'm so happy that you're here. I was honored that you asked me to contribute to your book, and I'm excited to talk more about what this is about. I'm so passionate. It's like the book about what I care about, basically. I'm like, thank you for making it.
Well, thank you so much for being willing. I think the last time that we got to have a face-to-face, voice-to-voice conversation was when I was interviewing you for the book. And now it's here in the world, and for better or worse, it's, you know, flapping its wings and, you know, spreading far and wide. So, yeah, I'm so eager. When I shared it with you and others who are in the book, I've been so eager to kind of dive in and see what they think and what they would add to the overall sort of message. Because each person, oh my gosh, just there's such a wealth of wisdom contained in the pages. So It's been a real pleasure. Yeah.
Well said. Well, let's focus on you for now. Tell me about your relationship to consciousness as a child. There's a lot of consciousness in your life, I can tell. It's been there.
Well, I grew up in an environment that was very interpersonal and very social. I grew up in a home that had 7 people. And I started to notice early on how much I really valued solitude because of that, because it was so rare. I shared a bedroom until I was a teenager. It was just a lot of hustle and bustle, and was active in the church community. And so, whenever possible, I would just kind of find my way to the edges and find my way to less activity and the quiet. And, some of my most poignant memories are of laying in the grass in our backyard. Or laying in the grass at my grandma's house under this plum tree that she had. And I would lay on my belly and rest my chin on my hands and just let the grass become really big, like a forest. And I would just lay there waiting for something or someone to pass by and just watch the little critters. And it felt like a meditation. I don't think I had the language for it then, but everything would just shift and I would sort of tune out the world, and it just felt like this place of quiet where I could hear everything. And at that time, my framework for it was, I viewed it as like talking to God, you know, and it was like, if I really like got my belly on the ground and would listen, I could hear God better. And so I would do my little prayers and think about everyone I loved and think about how big I was compared to the ladybugs and roly-polies, and then how small I was compared to the trees. And I felt like that was a thread that stayed through as I grew up into adolescence and beyond. Because there was just this sense that less is more. And I was getting a lot of messages about consciousness and about spirituality through my external environment. But what really felt true for me was that, like, oh, everything is actually just right here, you know? So yeah, I mean, as I got older, that grew into a lot of time spent hiking, or what I would call like treasure hunting. On my friends, like, would have land around their houses, and we would just go looking for little berries or twigs. And I think that sort of meditative time, unstructured with nature, has just always been a central part of how I've related with consciousness.
Oh, that's beautiful. It has me thinking of the way you integrated systems thinking and nature and ecology into the book. Can you speak about that a little bit?
Oh, yeah. Well, one thing I found was that it felt impossible to write about the world of plant medicine and psychedelics and to write about humans' relationship to healing without the natural world being central in that conversation. And at first I thought, is this going to land? Like, are people going to get the connections here? But I really did feel like the deeper I went into the writing process, the more that those themes started to emerge, because really it was just like a seeking out of and recognizing of the patterns that kind of are like fractal and within everything. And so I also just feel like there's so much wisdom and understanding that we can gain from really communing with our home planet, the natural world. And so I think there was a part of me that felt like it was like a little bit of like an inception mode, where I was like, if I can have a lot of these ideas be suggestive of nature and point people to that, maybe they will associate, maybe psychedelic naive people or beginners will associate expanded states with communing with nature. And I think that would be a good thing. So I'm kind of like putting in my own little biased beliefs in there as well, which I'll fully, you know, own.
Very ethical of you to.
I know, right? Own it. I'm like, let me say this up front.
Yeah, I think that the medicines themselves seem to be biased toward having us relate with nature and ourselves as a part of nature, the oneness. I mean, these are themes of the journey, as I understand.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. And the more I talk to people, the more that feels like a constant. Maybe I won't say a universal, but again and again, you know, I think that's a takeaway. In fact, I was just speaking with a friend who's coordinating a plant medicine retreat for environmental activists. And it's like a week-long thing. It will be up here in Oregon this summer. And it felt like a deeper layer of this very thing, which is working with plant medicines to tend to people who are working with and protecting the land. And I'm really excited to hear how that goes and how we can support that continuing. So.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah, my dear friend is a Buddhist eco-chaplain, and she similarly does like chaplaincy work with folks who are in the environment, the fight to stop climate change or preserve the natural environment. And she, we talk about nature, and she's always like, I'm looking for another word, because nature sounds like something that we go out and go into, but it's actually, it is us, and it's... what's the word for, you know, that what we are already in right now?
Mm-hmm. Did she identify one, or is she still working on it?
I think she's still working on it, but I think she's going to be a guest on the show soon. So I'll have to, for all the dedicated listeners that listen to every episode, first of all, I love you. And so TBD, we'll have to find out from her. Her name is Alana.
Yeah, I have that same struggle sometimes, because I don't want to talk about nature as this thing we go to visit and then we come back to our homes, you know. Yeah. Really been trying to deconstruct that, and even, you know, having relationships with, I live in, you know, North Portland, I'm in the city on a main road, but we have all the crows and the squirrels and the, you know, even like my pet cats, like they're all reminders like, oh, we are nature, you know. Sounds kind of wooey if you say it that way, but it's so true.
Embrace the woo. Like a, I don't know if this is appropriate to call it this, but almost like a code switching in the psychedelic world in some senses. Like some people are comfortable with the language of clinical trials and psychedelic assisted therapy, the default mode network, et cetera, whereas others are really turned off by that. And it's the more like, I don't know, dare I say feminine communication that resonates.
Yeah, and that was something, I mean, it's something I continue to grapple with because I feel like being in different environments, you kind of have to be able to engage in different ways. And I mean, code switching is such a big thing that has to be acknowledged anyway, and for, you know, certain people more than others. But I know that there's certain spaces where you have to have a certain grasp on some of that in order to get the work done that you're trying to do. And then at the same time, for me, it feels like such a relief to be, you know, with my team at Alma Institute in particular, because we have a shared language and understanding that I feel like is balanced, and also that we can laugh at ourselves, because at this point it feels like everything that comes out of our mouths has become a cliche, but we also know it holds weight and meaning. So it's like, we're going to allow that this is silly or cheesy. We're going to send memes to each other about it. And also we're going to take what we do really seriously. And yeah, I don't know. I feel like there's been this movement to like embrace the cringe lately. And it's just like a running joke, but also it's actually like very helpful.
Absolutely. Yeah. I once ran into someone who was a medicine facilitator that I didn't resonate with very much. And, I think they were on medicine when we ran into each other. And I was like, how have you been? And they were like, showing up, doing the work. And they just kept saying that over and over. Like, it was kept looping and like, yeah, just showing up, you know, showing up, doing the work. So that's what my friends and I always joke, like, how are you doing? Yeah, showing up, doing the work, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Exactly. That's such a great illustration.
Oh,
I feel like I might have run into that same person.
It was in Northern California.
Oh, so funny. Showing up, doing the work.
What else can we do? You've been showing up and doing the work. What was it like to birth this baby? I mean, you created Alma. It was just like, I mean, are you just going to keep creating amazing things? Like, what's the deal here?
I have been asked this quite a few times, particularly in my dating life, because you can imagine, I have a 10-year-old son, too, who's, you know, at the heart of my world. And so there's only so much space in one little person's attention. And right now, this is a very, like, birthing time. So it was Alma Institute, which is still, I'm the executive director, so it's my day-to-day. I lead the team, and we have this training program, and we're working towards a service center. So that I feel is still very precious and requiring a lot of my attention. And that was part of my hesitation with the book, because I love to write, you know, that's part of what I do in the field and had done before working in psychedelics, but the opportunity to write this book kind of landed in my lap in a way that is really, really humbling, because it doesn't happen often. The publishers reached out to me about 2 years ago. It was March of 2022. And I thought it was a spam email at first, because it basically said, do you want to write a book in the subject line? I was like, what is this? So I opened it, and it was the acquisitions team at North Atlantic Books. And these publishers are incredible. They are so oriented towards movement work and justice and healing. And they said, there's a book we need to see in the field that we want to get written. And we've been asking around to our, you know, other authors, and several people have said, have you spoken with Rebecca? So here I am, would you be interested in discussing the possibility of putting together a book or an anthology about psychedelic ethics and justice? So at the time, you know, Alma Institute was in its infancy. We were writing the curriculum for the psilocybin facilitator training. And I was just thinking, like, how in the world am I going to find time to make a book? And it's not only about the time, but the weight of what is being suggested here is this is a really, really important topic that many, many people have been working on for years. And how do you synthesize the weight of that into 200 pages? You know, you will barely scratch the surface. And who am I to be the one to be that spokesperson, you know? And consulted with mentors and, you know, went back and forth. And finally they said, well, you know how to share the mic and you know how to do it in your way that feels like it's truly an integrity and this needs to be in the world. So just think about that. And so I ended up agreeing, and it ended up being my kind of nights and weekends project. For I spent about a year writing it, and then a year with the team editing. I accidentally went way over. I sent them about 150,000 words. It was supposed to be 75,000 to 80,000. So we had to have the grueling process of cutting down the content by half. And eventually I just surrendered to them. I said, I've gotten it down as much as I can. You all are the professionals. You'll have to take it from here. And they were able to get it down into something really concise that still highlights about 20 interviews with the people who have taught me and led me and who I felt have so much just wisdom around these different elements of practice that we should all be thinking about and reflecting on as we navigate the world of psychedelics. So yeah, the journey continues. I'm feeling a deep call in my bones to slow down. And so I'm trying to set things up in a way that will allow that. And I do think I've kind of taken a page out of your book, Leah, but I think it's going to take a year or two to say yes to less things and to wrap up some of the things I'm focused on. I'm fantasizing about taking a proper vacation this summer or fall, which I've not done for 2 years. I've traveled quite a bit for Alma, but yeah, just trying to walk the walk, you know, make time to be with the medicines and not just talk about them.
Yep.
May we all heed that advice. Oh my gosh, yes. And make time to integrate, you know, not just talk about integration. I want to be about it. So I think that's the next chapter.
Oh, yes, yes. All of that for you. I'm thinking of this idea that the next Buddha will be not an individual, but a collective, will be, you know, the wisdom together of us, of a community. And I love how your book is like that. Like, it's almost as if you threw a party for all different folks who have, you know, something to say about this, who care about ethics and consent. And then reading the book is like walking around this party with you and having a private chat where you're like, well, I met so-and-so when I was doing this and I really liked how they did that. And then we go talk to them and you hear what they say. And then it's like your little reflections after, or you're breaking down, this is spiritual bypassing. This is that. Like, it was so, such a beautiful journey, like a walk with you to all these different places and people and all the while they're being woven together into a tapestry. That is the crux of it, you know, the whole medicine. Like,
Oh, I love that. That's exactly how I wanted the book to feel. I've struggled to describe it, but thank you for those words.
Yeah. Something else that stuck out to me, I think in the introduction you say how you've sat on both sides of the altar. And so I want to ask about that experience. First I'll say, I think we all should sit on both sides of the altar if we can. We all being, let's see, could I be more specific? I think I'll just stick to I statements, I guess. I'm really glad that I've sat on both sides of the psychedelic altar, that, you know, I help people who are on their own journeys with plant medicine, and I've been helped, and I receive help, and I still, you know, someone holds space for me. I still sit in ayahuasca ceremony. So I think that it's part of the power dynamics to not just be in the dominant position of holding space, because it is a dominant position. And there are many reasons to put oneself in the other position, you know, from ethics and keeping power dynamics in check to being able to empathize and resonate with the experience of someone that is taking medicine, you know, and is subjecting themselves to that vulnerability and giving themselves that gift. So I was thinking about that, but then also, because I was thinking about conflict when I was reading that sentence, I was thinking, at first, I thought you meant you've been on both sides of harm and conflict, as in you've been harmed and you've caused harm. Oh, because you said that you were a survivor. So I think I was a little bit primed to be thinking about harm. And then I realized that that wasn't what you meant, but I related with, like, I feel I have been on both sides of that altar. And yet you're nodding. So then, yeah.
Yes, I think I'm actually, I'm glad that that was how you read it, because that is also true. And I know there's a bit that we kind of dive into that in the chapter on accountability. And I think they're actually really intertwined, because, and that's not to say that inherently to hold power is to do harm, but the risk that is inherent with holding power, and even, you know, rightful authority or authority that you've been entrusted with, the risks do increase the more power and responsibility that you have. And I think any time I really start to identify with one experience that I've had, part of my internal exercise is, well, is the opposite also true? Have I been in the other shoes? And that exercise of seeking understanding and pursuit of empathy, I think is so, so important. And especially when we talk about harm, you know, I am a sexual assault survivor. I have experienced other types of harm in my life, as we all have. And I've been the one who's done harm and had people come to me and say, hey, I need to have a conversation with you. Like, this happened that wasn't okay, and we need to find repair. And that has been one of the hardest and most healing aspects of just growing up as a person and finding my way, has been just the humility that comes with it, but also the relief to acknowledge that that is part of being human and finding our way, is failing. And to me, the belonging that can happen when repair and accountability are engaged with meaningfully and held in community, and when there is space for the mess and the process and for the unresolved and for things to take as long as they need, I don't know something more healing than that, actually, because the way that it weaves the fabric of a community and strengthens what's possible, you know, I need that. I grew up in a very conflict avoidant environment, not only my home environment, but then in this church environment, which is just built on denial of a lot of things. And so just normalizing conflict, I mean, that is one of the most pivotal shifts from being a young person into adulthood, was, oh, conflict can be healthy. Conflict can teach us a lot and actually be good and generative and illuminating of where we need to grow in major ways. And so now I think that all of my relationships have a debt of gratitude to me learning how to be humble and mess up, and also, you know, ask the people around me to do the same.
Yeah. There's certainly a gender component to it. You know, being socialized as women feels like is a part of this. And then I see myself sometimes trying to act as though I could potentially never harm anyone ever. And like, if I just, like, if I never ask for anything, if I never, but that's not the way either. Yeah, that's I need to remember to embrace and honor conflict as the agent, you know, and it's conflict within relationships and then conflict in community, like that individual and community that tends to bring the drama a little bit or like whatever that stirs the pot. And those mm-hmm. people are very important to the ecosystem. Starhawk talks about that in the empowerment manual, like that one who can just explode a meeting. They are bringing forth something important also.
Yes, it's I think just our attachment to order and our attachment to control and predictability. I think that's part of, for myself, what makes conflict so unsettling. It's not even that there's conflict. It's that things are not going according to plan, and the having to surrender to that and allow space to slow down for one, but also for the mess, you know, it's hard. Yeah. Starhawk's right, though.
Do you have, so you were invited to write this book, though I'm sure that you generated intention along the way of what it would be. And like you said, you wanted it to read as kind of a little tour. Do you have hopes for what this book will do in the world? Intentions, desires? Dream big, okay? Don't ask for what you think you can get. Ask for what you want.
Okay. I'm still waiting for Michael Pollan to tweet about it. I want Michael Pollan's audience to read this book because I think that it's necessary. Which I know that's just like a funny side one. But really, as I was writing this book, the people that I was thinking about most are the people who are so craving, desiring, and needing healing experiences. And I guess some people might call them the psychedelic naive, you know, the people who are new to this whole world. And they're essentially just arriving in the metaphorical lobby of whatever this gathering space is. And who is going to be there to help them get oriented and feel empowered to find their way and have the safest, most nourishing, most rewarding experience possible if they choose to go down these roads of expanded states. And so I think that the book really does have a thesis, even though I try to leave so much to the reader. And, you know, my agenda is really for us to reconsider some of our assumptions around the power dynamics that we think have to be there within psychedelic healing and psychedelic therapy spaces in order for people to heal. And, you know, if I could help spark or further that conversation and give fuel to that fire, which is we have to shrink the power dynamics between those who are seen as the experts, the therapists, the gurus, the shamans, whatever environment, and the participants or the journeyers who really are doing the work and who at the end of the day are the authority on what they need most and what healing looks like for them. And that way I do feel that this book is a contribution. And I think most of the feedback I've started to get, one of the through lines I've seen is people saying, this was so validating and normalizing because I just came back from XYZ experience and there were things that did not feel right. And now I have language around it. And so my hope is not only to validate and normalize, but also to get out in front of those things so that people can have some tools before they set out to go find an experience or a group to work with. And to really be a tool for prevention. At one point in the book, I say, I hope this book can be an immunological offering. Like, can we strengthen the health of the system that we find ourselves in, that is the psychedelic field, so that we can consistently be letting go of what is not good for us and orienting towards actually, I think most of us who are in this field have you know what I'm referring to. There's something so beautiful. There's something that holds so much rich potential for human healing and for these times that we're in. But we have to come back to that again and again. And so I just hope it can be a reference. I hope it can spark conversations that are maybe hard to have without something to point to. I hope more people can heal in ways that are actually sustainable and good for them.
Yes, may it be so. I like the analogy of the immunological offering. As an allergy sufferer, I am also thinking about that the immune response can be misattuned and can overly respond to something that's not actually a threat in that particular context. So that comes to mind. Mm-hmm. And then I just want to, were you going to say something there?
No, please go ahead.
Okay. So then before that, the shrinking the power dynamic, yes. You talk about discernment in the book, and I think for facilitators to be able to discern what gratification they are taking from holding space for people, and if that gratification is something like, I'm such a great healer, or they're like actually energetically like vampiring, like taking the agency from the client, like, yes, I'm sure that they have a lot of skills and that they held a good space. At the same time, this was the medicine and the person working together, and you're gatekeeping the context and the container, giving support to the person as they go through and do the work. That's why, like, whenever anyone thanks me, I say, like, you're doing the hard work. Like, I'm just here cheering you on, like, being so blessed and honored to watch your process.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's so true. And I have an interview with Dr. Angela Carter in the book, and that was one thing that I really connected with them on. They said something to the effect of, it's impossible to hold space for people without being transformed yourself, because just the weight of what you get to witness, it is such a deep honor, and it should inherently be so humbling to where whoever's holding space should be thanking, you know, the participant, thank you for trusting me to be a part of this experience with you. It's you're watching entire, you know, ancestral lineages like shift and heal, and there's so much that can happen. And it brings me to tears every time I think about, you know, the loved ones who have trusted me to be their safe person. And and at the same time, it's so important to watch that part that is having a need met or a desire met through being in a helping environment, you know? And I think that's why I start the book talking about inner work. And, you know, do we each who are holding space, do we have a therapist? Do we have someone holding space for us? Are we in touch with what Laura May Northrup calls our shadow whys? You know, are we in touch with the shadow why? That's not to say that we need to eradicate it, but being really, really conscious and aware of those parts that are getting fed by holding space for others.
Yeah. So important not to banish or attempt to exile those. They'll just be even more shadowy.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Ain't that the truth?
I'll just put this out there so that somewhere in the world it is spoken. The psychedelic safety flags did come out. They have a website. Yay.
Amazing.
So I'll put that in the show notes. But if anyone reads, I highly recommend everyone read this book, even like in the psychedelic world or not, because there's so much in it that translates to other realms as well. No pun intended on the realm bit, but the psychedelic safety flags is something that I mentioned in my interview of a guideline that are subjective. You know, what is a red flag for me may not be a red flag for another person who has a different set of life experiences and values and perspective, but just a general guide to facilitator behavior that's on the spectrum of green flag, like seems safe, is good, from yellow to yellow flag, oh, maybe concerning, orange flag, this is approaching potentially abusive, and then red flag being this is behavior you might want to steer away from. That exists, and it's a living document, and anyone who wants to check it out can do so at psychedelicsafetyflags.com.
Thank you so much for creating that. Truly, I felt like that was the reference that I need to put it on my website, because it's, in terms of resources, I know it's hard because things are subjective, but getting specific, I think, is huge for people, because we don't want to always be vague and talking about, you know, trust your intuition. It's like, here are some examples. And I know you really put in the work to really unpack why certain things could be inherently like something to have caution around. It's not just, this is what I think. It's, this is how the potential for abuse grows if these dynamics are at play, you know, and that, oh, I mean, we should be having that front and center as, you know, we decriminalize and we create more avenues to access that piece of public education, not just around, here's how these substances work in your brain, here's what the research is showing us, but the real world application means interpersonal relationships are involved with accessing psychedelics almost all the time in one way or another. And so I hope that the flags system and that your work really reaches far.
Thank you for the recognition. And it was a community effort. Absolutely. It is so interpersonal, isn't it? And the unique nature of this, like the something that's been underground while it's been in, you know, our Western society with prohibition, because I don't want to say it's always been underground, like this, you know, the history of the medicines is, we don't have time to go into it here. And I think a lot of people listening know, but these medicines have their lineages of thousands of years of use in indigenous cultures. It's a very unique thing. They are legally available in some contexts, going to be more so, and there's still going to be an underground. And I think the DIY sort of the mutual aid stuff, the guides like this, Laura and May Northrup's book, A Table of Our Own, they all kind of showcase this, like, how community is holding it together as community, and not some scientists saying how this is how you do it. But they can come too. They can be part of the community too. But they're not the leaders. The community is what's leading, and that's where the strength is.
It's so important, you know. And I feel like I have to say it again and again, because working in a regulated access program like I do in Oregon, I do come up against this sort of binary sometimes, which is, you know, being around folks who are really the science, the research, this like psychedelic therapy, even the quote medical model is the way. And I take every opportunity I can to say that that's part of the whole. One of my dear friends and mentor, Robert Stanley, or as people know him, Bob Otis, he always says, we need the all and, you know. He leads this beautiful entheogenic church in Oakland, Sacred Garden community. And I think the false sort of opposition that we hear about a lot between like this community-based model and the medical model, to me, I think that there are some inherent tensions, but really more pathways to access for people and more choices for people to identify what is right for them in their context. That is part of dismantling the drug war. It's not just the medical model. It's not just, you know, strengthening the underground. Those are parts of it. It's definitely not just regulated access. Regulated access is an expensive route forward. I'll just say that it is expensive. And I think that people will have transformative experiences. And we have to get the knowledge and the tools and the skills and systems for apprenticeship and systems for supervision out into the world beyond just legal above ground, quote, you know, regulated access. Because that's, I think, a very small slice of the pie in terms of where this healing work's actually happening. So, you know, that's why I'm excited. You know, a book is $20 and anyone could, you know, hopefully it's like, if anyone's interested, that they're reading books and empowering themselves with knowledge and surrounding themselves with community and with mentors and elders, regardless of, you know, you don't have to wait for regulated access in your hometown to start learning about psychedelic ethics. I think if you're interested in psychedelics, the next obvious step is really getting clear on your ethics around it.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Right. Well, I want to ask about your consciousness hack, but if there's, there is a little bit of time, if you'd just like to say anything more beyond where we went in our little meandering conversation.
Yeah. You know, I was actually thinking I might read a little blurb out of the book. This may be cutting to the chase, but I have a little section where I actually talk about, like, what do I mean when I say whole medicine? And I think that might be a nice to share. And then I'll share my silly but great little consciousness hack.
Thank you, Stella.
So this portion is very early on in the book. It's in the section called What is Whole Medicine? And I'm just going to read maybe two paragraphs here. The topic of healing is a huge one. It's a question that is central to our existence as conscious beings who experience pain and connection. When we reflect deeply on the notion of healing, there is a common thread that emerges: the idea of repair, restoration, and accessing our innate wholeness. The notion of medicine can conjure many associations, from pharmaceuticals to memories of soul-stirring experiences. What connects these concepts is the potential to help us, body, mind, and soul, to do us good, usually thought of on a personal level. Whole medicine proposes that healing is in its very essence collective. It denies the fantasy that some of us can heal while looking the other way at the harms being done around us. It calls us to begin within ourselves, become aware of the conditions we are steeped in, and show up in service of change. Whole medicine is not just about feeling better. It is about living differently. Whole medicine insists that we do not stop with our own healing, but that we allow ourselves to be interrupted by the worthy pursuit of a more just and beautiful world. Whole medicine acknowledges that when we really let the medicines in, they could change everything by changing us.
Thank you.
And then I spend about 200 pages unpacking that, but
gotta do it. And I think that by changing us, they too are changed, right? That's the dynamic interplay and unfolding of this, like, inseparable relationship.
I love that so much. And it's something that occurred to me. I was sitting in my office. I was about halfway through writing the book, and this thought just hit me, which is, and I had thought it before, but it was so visceral, it brought me to tears, was like, how are the medicines doing right now? How is this for them? And have we asked, and have we listened enough? And are we listening enough to really hear how they're doing? And that's been a part of my process ever since, and a part of my inquiry, which is, it's again coming back to where we started. I have to get so quiet to hear them, you know, especially in my default sensorial reality. I have to get really quiet and listen. And what do you need? You know, do you want me to have a ceremony right now? Maybe you don't. Maybe you want some space and respect. And then more broadly, I think that's a collective thing we need to be inquiring about, is how are we tending to the spirit and the heart of the medicines in a way that is loving and caring and understanding of our impact on them and this inherent relationship we have. And I trust the communities. I see so much beautiful work being done around slowing down and really being in relationship in a way that's not just throwing around the word sacred reciprocity, but, you know, truly unpacking what that looks like.
Yes. Oh, thank you. Yeah. All right. So tell us your silly, funny, awesome little thing.
Okay. So you asked, what's your consciousness hack? And I was like, oh, maybe it needs to be some really profound thing. But this is something that I do every day. That I've been doing really for about 2 years that has been very liberating for me. I call it giving myself pockets of permission throughout the day. And the practical tool is really I use my phone timer for everything. Because I can't work in big blocks of the day because my attention is quite sporadic and unpredictable. And so some people call it, like, I initially learned it as like the Pomodoro technique, which is like you'll work really focused for 25 minutes and then give yourself the 5 minute break and then do it again. And over time, I realized that giving myself permission to focus really intently on one thing and shut everything out, as a parent, as someone who's like, I have a lot of people who need things from me all the time, that's been very freeing, which is I will let myself do it because I know that I'm not going to get lost in it. I know I'll come back and be reachable for everything else. So now I use it for everything. I'm like, oh, I need a little break. I'm going to take a little snack break for 15 minutes and, you know, watch something on Netflix. I'll set the timer so I don't have to burden myself with thinking, do I need to get back? It's almost like this, the little bell jingles. I go, okay, great. Now I'm going to give myself permission to pivot to this intense focus. Give myself permission to go get to my son's school early so I can practice my Spanish in the car, you know, or whatever the thing is. So yeah, I just, and then I will say, I also have one day a week that I give myself permission to be completely unstructured and to be my most ADHD self. And that has been so joyous. Usually on Sundays, I go really slow. I have my, what I call my head to toe day. So I do my full hair wash, all my skin stuff, do a little sauna thing, and then meander through my home or my neighborhood doing whatever I want in the most non-methodological way. permission has been very liberating. And as a byproduct, I have actually become more productive and more focused. So I guess that's freeing in itself too.
Wow. I love that. I love when boundaries and containment is freeing. It's the same for me as well. I love my timer too. And just like being able to be immersed in something, knowing that the timer's got me, I'm not going to go over.
Yeah. And as someone who I think I'm inherently rebellious in many ways, it was very freeing for me to realize that when I can choose structure for myself and when I can decide what that looks like, it's very liberating. And it's different for everyone.
Well, I hope that you structure in a vacation for yourself soon.
Thank you.
I can't remember if that was
working on it.
You're working on it. Was that on the air or off the air? I can't remember what you were saying. Maybe that was our check-in before.
Yes, but I'll say it again. I'm going to be accountable to taking 7 to 10 days off, totally unreachable, hopefully by some beautiful waters somewhere. Yeah, and I'm already taking steps to make that happen. I think it'll be good for everyone.
And so it is. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Leah. Thank you. Oh, it's been a pleasure.